Unitarian Universalism is really hard to understand within the framework of organized religion. As Voltaire was said to have said of the Holy Roman Empire, that it was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire, Unitarian Universalism, calling it organized, assumes facts not in evidence, and calling it a religion, is a little misleading in terms of how most people in the West think about what a religion is. Unitarian Universalism doesn't have a creed or a confession. There isn't one thing that you memorize that tells you the meaning of life, how to find salvation, the stories, the myths that should inform your spirit, inform your hearts, and eventually inform your hands. We see wisdom and folly in the history of every religion, and we understand religion as a system for people to find a sense of community and a sense of meaning within that community. It can be toxic or it can be nourishing. And when we look around the world as universalists, and I'll get to the distinction between Unitarians and Universalists, we see that there are good human beings and miserable human beings of every religion, including our own. So that when somebody tells you what their religion is, you don't get an awful lot of really good information. When you look at how somebody leads their lives and spends their lives, it's much more indicative of the religion that they practice. Because our emphasis is on the practice as opposed to the beliefs. Unitarianism was born in, I'll give you the official version first, it was born in Spain, theoretically from Miguel Servetus, who looked at the Bible, which was really a strange thing to do. He read the Bible and he couldn't find the Trinity in the Bible. And he looked at the practice of how Roman Catholicism was practiced by many people, particularly the princes of the church, who dressed really nicely and had gold and silver and embroidered robes, and he couldn't relate the way that the princes of the church lived to the way that he saw Jesus living in the Gospels. And so he began to question the legitimacy of the institutional church and the doctrine of the Trinity, which he found to be extrinsic to the Bible. He was, when he was doing this, all of about 20. He was driven out of Spain and went to France, where he continued to write. He wrote a book called On the Errors of the Trinity, which was not deeply appreciated by the Catholic Church, and it turned out was not deeply appreciated by the Protestants either, because, in fact, Servetus, whose other profession was being a medical doctor, which is going to get me back to his provenance in a little bit, he was a medical doctor, and we claim that he discovered and articulated the circulation of blood before even Harvey. That's not the big rabbit, that's a scientist from a long time ago. So he was chased out of France, and he was actually burned at the stake, but not by the Catholics, by the Calvinists. So he managed to make enemies kind of wherever he went, which has been part of Unitarian tradition ever since. Unitarian started out as an epithet. As a movement, Unitarians are not self-named. People said, oh, those Unitarians, those heretics. Unitarianism gets picked up, incidentally, this was going on in 1514, shortly 1515, shortly after the reconquest of Spain. You all know that 1492 was a very bad year for American Indians, and it wasn't a better year for Muslims or Jews in Spain, because King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella completed the reconquest of Spain, and with it came kind of a reign of terror for people who were not Trinitarian Christian. Now I'm going to go off the reservation a little bit. It really strikes me that there's an untold story in Miguel Servetus of an influence from probably both Muslim and Jewish sources. His theology was around the unity of God and the denial of the Trinity. He was, in his day and in his way, a Christian. He believed in the prophetic mission of Jesus, in the moral example of Jesus, and that informed his life and his value system. So it's hard for me not to believe, that's a couple of twists to it, not to believe that there was Muslim and Jewish influence on him. His name, Miguel, is a Hebrew name, which means who is like unto God. And his last name, Servetus, is very interesting because it means the server. And the second most common name in Islam is Abdullah, which is servant, slave of God. So whether he comes from a Jewish background or a Muslim background, I don't know, and history doesn't know. But it seems clear that the radical monotheism of both Judaism and Islam informed his sense of the unity of God, and that you can't break God up into various pieces. His sense of the prophetic mission of Jesus could bespeak some Muslim influence, because as many of you know, that Jesus is the second most mentioned person in the Quran. That Jesus in the Quran is called the Word of God, the Sign of God, the Messenger of God, the Apostle of God, the Slave of God, but not the Son of God. So what those connections are remain somewhat vague, but so I'm not marketing this as a heretical branch of Islam. But I think that there, as in every religion, there are influences from predecessors and antecedents, and the Jewish and Muslim influence seems clear in Servetus. Unitarianism, this emphasis on the unity of God, gets picked up in Eastern Europe and Transylvania. And there was, we are so lucky to have a Francis David with us. Francis David in the Romania Transylvania of the 16th century was a priest, a Catholic priest, who then became a Protestant, who then became a Unitarian. And by that I mean a couple of things. One, he de-emphasized the issues of creed and opened up a world of religious tolerance. He helped bring the king of John Sigismund, the first and last Unitarian king, and helped him proclaim officially a doctrine of religious tolerance. It was a first for Europe, where by proclamation of the king, there was a declaration that said, the state has no right to tell people how to worship. The state has no right to select clergy, to clear sermons, to tell people what hymns to sing or what to believe. That every person ought to be allowed their own religion. And nobody should be persecuted because they are Catholic or Jewish or Protestant or Unitarian or Familialist and a bunch of other little sects that nobody's heard of. And this was a unique doctrine in Europe, and probably unique doctrine anywhere, to really begin to try to separate religion from the state, and to try to have the state not have a controlling interest in how worship was conducted. They wanted to avoid the internecine wars that they were seeing develop as Protestantism was born and was being developed, and that the Protestants were fighting the Catholics, and the Protestants themselves were breaking off into little groups, because, of course, when you have a large monolithic structure and it begins to fragment, usually all hell breaks loose. When the Catholic Church at various times in its history has said, you know, we know Galileo's right, but we don't want to admit it, because if the people lose confidence in us, all hell will break out. Well, sometimes they're right, you know. As that great sage Donald Rumsfeld said, words that you'll never hear again, democracy is messy. And when people started questioning the church, you just had all kinds of schisms and sects develop and start to fight each other. And Sigismund and Francis David were trying very hard to create a climate. You had two ways of going. You either go tolerance or you go intolerance and have a winner. And they tried for tolerance. Unitarianism, and again, it was an epithet directed at people, and Unitarians were smart enough to own the name and say, okay, so we're the Unitarians. We believe in the unity of God. As Unitarianism moved back westward across France and into England, it was picked up by people of an intellectual and scientific bent, particularly in France. It was heavily influenced and influenced the French deists, people who looked at the world and said, well, if God's in charge of everything, if God is micromanaging everything, then what is the nature of human responsibility? It looked at the world and said, God has given us intelligence, and maybe we should use it. Maybe we shouldn't just memorize other people's interpretations, but maybe we should explore existence, explore the solar system, the stars, and be free to have scientific inquiry. Maybe what God did was, and you all know the image of the clock winder, that God created everything, set the natural laws of this universe. I will not speak today about multiverses and other bubbles out there, but set the laws in of this universe, and we should be exploring them and doing our best to understand and to make the world and agriculture and society work. Of course, it did not spread like wildfire, because the responsibility of inquiry, of judgment, of deciding for yourself, it leaves people without the eternal certainties that can be very comforting. And so it was picked up very much on a class and educational basis. However, by the time it got to England, it started to bifurcate and became much more open. You had the intellectuals, you had the great colonial and industrial families of England who were Unitarians. You had the Darwins, Darwin's mother, and you had part of the Darwin family, the Huxley family, and the Wedgwood family. You had some of the great upper middle class scientific people of 19th and 18th century English business, commerce, and intellectual pursuits. You also had, and here is something that you've all been waiting for, you all know the word, even if you can't spell it, anti-disestablishmentarianists. Well, the Unitarians were for the disestablishment of the Church of England as a state church. They wanted the state and the church to be pulled apart so that people could have congregational control and what we call congregational polity. So the Unitarians, along with the Methodists, were the disestablishmentarianists against whom the anti-disestablishmentarianists were anti. Any questions? Okay. So that's the context of the word anti-disestablishmentarianism. These were the people that didn't like the Unitarians trying to separate the state, the crown, from religion. And they didn't want to do it, one, because they didn't want the Archbishop of Canterbury or the King or the Queen telling them how to lead their spiritual lives, and a little Marxist economic determinism, they also didn't want to pay taxes to a church that they didn't attend, which is, I have different feelings about that, maybe a little bit like people who send their kids to private school who don't want to pay property taxes, but let's not go there. So Unitarianism was picked up by the intellectuals, by the academics, but it was also picked up by a lot of working class people who didn't want the intrusion of the church, the state church, in their lives and wanted congregational polity so that there is a Unitarian college at Oxford called Manchester College. And that kind of bespeaks the fact that at Manchester, which was a working area, had a high number of Unitarians, of people who were working class, who wanted to gather their own congregations together and wanted independence from the control of the crown. As Unitarianism spread westward from Transylvania, where it was very Christocentric. And by Christocentric, I mean if you understand Romanian or Hungarian, and you go to a church service in Transylvania, it will seem very Christian, because Jesus and Christ are words that are used a lot, and the prayers are relatively orthodox, even if there is no Trinity. If you want to experience that in English, go to Boston to King's Chapel. King's Chapel is what they call old school. King's Chapel in Boston has Queen Anne silver communion plates that was given to them by Queen Anne. They do communion, and it looks like the Book of Common Prayer with all references to the Trinity taken out. So if your style is Christocentric, it's a very easy fit. You can feel very Episcopalian in there. But in general, as Unitarianism spread westward from Transylvania to France to England, it became ever more theologically open, if not unconstitutionally vague. So that the first part was the divinity of Jesus was questioned, then the active role of God in everyday affairs, answering your prayers for the Steelers to win, and for you actually to make the catch at the end. They didn't really believe in a God that responded in those ways, unless you really pledged a lot. And then maybe there was some influence, but that's my own personal view. It's still open if anybody has some playoff money they want to give me, and I'll do what I can. That's another important feature of Unitarian Universalism. Its clergy is not a priesthood. Its clergy is selected by the congregations. It is, in a sense, the radical part of the Reformation, but it's also radical in its congregational polity. It is the congregation who selects and ordains clergy, not any larger institution. So that congregations can ordain Caligula's horse, and have from time to time, but that's the power of the individual. It is radical congregationalism. It is the individual community's power to hire, to fire, to choose, to raise, to smash down their own leadership. By the time Unitarianism gets to this continent, I like to say that it is Jesus optional till it gets to England, then it becomes God optional when it gets to New England, and by the time it gets to Big Sur in San Francisco, it becomes clothing optional, which happened a lot in the 60s, but our bodies were better then. There have been arguably four Unitarian presidents of the United States. Unitarianism isn't just this tiny little aberrant movement, although it is a tiny little aberrant movement. It was a major force in the creation of this nation and in the creation of the 20th century. The great Unitarians, and I'll throw in the Universalists in a minute, were instrumental in the birth of this nation. From Thomas Paine, who was a typical Unitarian troublemaker. Paine was his right name. He was a pain to nearly everybody. To Thomas Jefferson, whom we count as a Unitarian because he said nice things about us, although he never actually joined a Unitarian church. But you see, even then, Unitarians were not joiners. So the proof of his Unitarianism was that he didn't join a Unitarian church. It's a little perverse, I admit, but it's a plausible theory. He went through the Bible and the Jefferson Bible and cut out the miracles, the things that offended reason, the something that Unitarians still do. One of my favorite things is to watch Unitarians sing hymns. As my chronic members know, my favorite thing is Silent Night. Watching Unitarians sing Silent Night, night, all is calm, all is bright, round yon mother and child. Just cutting out the parts that we don't agree with, which is very strange because up at DeBeneville, Unitarians will sing Give Me a Home Where the Buffalo Roam, and very few of us want a home with buffalo roaming in it. But we don't feel like hypocrites when we do that. So we had Thomas Paine, arguably Thomas Jefferson, clearly John Adams and John Quincy Adams, and Benjamin Franklin attended Unitarian churches both in England and in what became the United States. Unitarianism was very hot in New England, which, of course, is why our headquarters, as well as our hindquarters, are in Boston on 25 Beacon Street. And New England probably still is the population center of gravity, is probably east of the Mississippi for Unitarian Universalists in terms of numbers. In the 1870s, and this is really important because it becomes, in a sense, the 19th century version of the Francis David, John Sigismund's Declaration of Religious Tolerance. In the 1870s, at a meeting of the Unitarians, it was voted that Unitarianism would not be creedally Christian, that it was open to people of all faiths of goodwill. And so this, again, creates the confusion. If you are a religion, shouldn't you have a position on who God is and what God wants? Shouldn't you have a position on what are the divine documents of your faith? Shouldn't you have a creedal statement and a catechism? And I think the closest thing that Unitarians get to a creedal statement is in one of the banners up there, which is Francis David's, "We do not have to think alike to love alike." Or if you want to put it in the New Testament, "Ye are known by your fruits, not simply by what you say." Let me pick up the Universalists. So the Unitarians and Universalists officially merged in the early 1960s. But there was a difference. The Universalists come from a much more Christian tradition. They took more seriously and more literally the idea of salvation and the idea that Jesus' life and possibly death were exemplary or instruments of salvation. They looked at how so many religions said, you don't agree with me, I'm sorry, you're going to have to burn in hell, and said, what kind of God would do that? And so they believed that the word Unitarian meant originally the unity of God. I think today it means the unity of humanity. Universalist meant that God was too good to damn us, and that if salvation was offered, it was offered to everyone. I was telling Nick on the way down here, and let me just tell you who Nick is a little bit, just to embarrass you. I married Nick's parents, and his mother was a member of my Studio City congregation. I was telling Nick on the way down that I had a friend in seminary who was a Lutheran and a very nice guy, and he came up to me one day and said, John, you're really a good guy. I'm so sorry you're going to burn in hell for eternity. And I said, well, me too. Oh, wow, he's certainly strict, isn't he? And I said, so why am I going to burn in hell? And he said, well, you know, it's not up to me. It's what God said. God said the only way to salvation, Jesus said the only way to salvation is through the Son. The only way to the Father is to the Son. And I said unto him, well, you can pick and choose that, but what about Jesus turning to the thief on the cross next to him and said, I tell you verily this day you will dwell with me in paradise. Why don't you pick that one out? Because the thief wasn't a Christian. Well, and it said, well, I have to go ask my teacher. So he came back and he said, well, the thief had a baptism by the Holy Spirit. I said, no fair. You know, if you're going to be a fundamentalist, you don't get to add things to Scripture. It's in the Scripture or it's not in the Scripture. We can fight about interpretation, but if you're really going to be a fundamentalist, you know, just saying it's a baptism by the Holy Spirit is like a locked door mystery, where the detective says, well, I have a glarg that, you know, that detects through walls what's going on. That's not kosher. So I said to him, that's not kosher. And I said, you know, I'm a bad guy. I have violent fantasies. I get angry at people. But there's nobody who I would burn in hell, not for a minute, not for an hour, not certainly not for eternity. Why would I worship a God who is less forgiving, less tolerant, less open than I am? If I'm going to have a God, I want the God to be an example. And frankly, when I see the parts of the Gospels where there's a teaching of tolerance, how can you love God whom you have not seen if you love not your brother whom you have seen? So love one another. Why aren't you focusing on that part? Why do you think that God's worse than I am? And his eyes glazed over and they started circulating in different directions. But the basic premise of universalism is that salvation is open to everyone of every faith. Thomas Starr King was a Unitarian minister. Every state has two heroes or heroines who are commemorated in the Capitol in Washington and the Rotunda with statues. For California, it's interesting that it's two very different religious figures. It's Father Junipero Serra, and it's Thomas Starr King. Thomas Starr King, I take it back, was a Universalist minister who served the Unitarian Church in San Francisco and was instrumental in keeping California off the side of the Confederacy. Unitarians and Universalists have always, along with our Methodist friends, been involved in what's called social gospel, trying to live values of spreading, I hate to even use these words in this context, of spreading freedom, of seeing the humanity in others, of seeing our responsibility to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, to plead for the widow and orphan, to be involved in the creation of some of the great social institutions that has characterized the very best of this nation. Free public education. Horace Mann was a Unitarian. Dewey, not the presidential candidate, but the decimal guy. If anybody remembers the Dewey decimal system, now that we've switched to digital, were Unitarians. The founder of Smith College, Aurelia Reinhart, Unitarians. Very big in education, disproportionate in the number of presidents, arguably for William Howard Taft was the other one. And again, he had a very clean, and Millard Fillmore. Millard Fillmore had a very clean administration. He had the first bathtub in the White House. That's his claim to fame. What can I tell you? You know, not all heroes are created equal. Florence Nightingale was a Unitarian. We argue that the first woman ordained in the United States, Olympia Brown, was a Unitarian. Methodists also claim her, so we're fighting over her soul, what can I tell you? Unitarians were instrumental in the abolitionist movement, worked hard, and the mixing of politics and religion has been a long part of the tradition, from the founding of this country to Channing, who talked about writing his sermons with a pistol and a sword on his desk because he was so involved in the anti-slavery movement that people were throwing things at his house and threatening his life. So Unitarians and Universalists have played a very important role in the development of the institutions of this country. We are a tiny, tiny percentage of the population. We are, however, on average, the most highly educated group in the United States, which nothing to brag about because it only shows our class bias, and the highest educational level of any group in the United States, unless you start to really microchip off the high end of the Episcopalians or the high end of Reconstructionist Judaism. But if you take Judaism or Episcopalianism, you'll find that Unitarians have a higher average income. Not necessarily wealth, but income. We also have the lowest per capita giving to religious organizations of any group. We're tied for last place with the Catholics, and sure, you can laugh. And that's kind of the nutshell version. Let me also point out one more thing from that Islamic part of Spain at the end of 1492. When Francis David and John Sigismund were living in Transylvania, it really was highly influenced by what can be called a Pax Turcica, that the Turkish Empire had a great deal of control, and there were Muslim communities alive at that time. And again, I think that that's not an accidental sense of the emphasis of the unity of God and the good works of Jesus and the good works that human beings owe each other. Will.
Why is it, or maybe it's just speculation, it would be just speculation to answer it, but it seems to me that the Western religions of Islam and Judaism and Christianity are all stuck on the idea that they have the one answer, and I don't really see that in Buddhism and Hinduism and so on, though maybe I'm just not familiar enough with them to know it. Maybe that's just a religious feature of all religions, but it seems to me it's
It's a feature of humanity. Look, this is to me the essential religious conundrum. We create religions to some extent to make ourselves better. And we create institutions that are made up of human beings who have all of the needs and insecurities and fears and greeds and avarice of every other group. So when I'm teaching comparative religion courses, I have what I call Dober's First Law. Being Dober, I get to write Dober's First Law, which is anything that you find in one religion, you will find in every religion, because we're made up of the same people. So that my generation and your generation idealized Hindus for a while in the 60s until they invaded Goa and started killing Sikhs, and we realized what they had done to Muslims when Pak India got independence. And so Buddhism started looking good, and I'm not making this up, there have been fighting wars between Buddhist monasteries over the interpretation of involuntary nocturnal emissions. They killed each other over the interpretation of them. This tells me that our issues are human issues. Unitarians can be just as screwed up as anybody else in the world. Being a Unitarian doesn't automatically make you a better person. It gives us a goal. And it gives us a goal of tolerance and inclusivity, which at least is moving up from the idea of think exactly as I do or I'll kill you, or God will kill you, which is the same thing. Because I think theology, as I was saying to the group on Thursday, theology has consequences. If God will burn me in hell, what responsibility do you have to take care of me, to feed me, to clothe me, to plead for me, to care for me, if God so hates me that he'll burn me in hell? But Unitarians can get into loud, screaming matches with each other. Marleys can beat up Al, and nobody will step in between the two of them. We can be as irrational as anybody else because we're made up of the same stuff. So it's really important that we understand that our tolerance and our inclusivity is a goal. It's not a reality.
In the mid-80s, when we went to church, and we were looking for a Unitarian church in Hampstead, north of London, where we were, we were associated with the Quakers. And it was derogatory. I mean, this was not a cheerful statement that we were getting. But was there ever any relationship?
Well, we didn't kill each other, which is really good. Well, as we were discussing last night on the phone, I went on beliefnet.com and took the quiz and found out that I was a Quaker. Unitarian didn't come up number one. Reformed Judaism didn't come up number one. Quaker came up number one. There's certainly philosophical fellow travelers in a lot of ways. And one of the things with Quakers, while Unitarians have clergy, as you know, the Quakers don't. They're completely lay-led. So there's a relationship in terms of the radical congregational polity and the strength of the congregation. There's also, I mean, I use a Quaker line a lot, which is, you know, I always feel funny when somebody says, pray for me, because my theology of prayer, for me, gets really messed up, because if I'm praying for you, and is my theology that God is going to say, oh, John, so good to hear from you, you know, I forgot all about her, and thank you for reminding me. The Quakers have a wonderful, wonderful line and image, which I borrow, and that is, I will hold you in the light. And the sense of the divine and a relationship with light goes into Judaism, into Christianity, into Islam, into all of the mystical systems, and into Hinduism and Buddhism. And the idea of holding each other gently in the light of love and of warmth is the kind of non-specific vagueness with which Unitarians tend to be comfortable. There is also, along with the Quakers and the Methodists, the social gospel aspects of doing good works. Of the emphasis in Unitarianism is we are not interested in saving your soul. Your soul is up to you. We're interested in saving your body so that you have the strength to deal with your own spiritual and soul issues. but there's not an institutional connection past that the American Friends Service Committee and the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee worked together very closely in dealing with refugees in World War II, and have had a long and fruitful cooperative relationship.
I know there are different groups of Quakers, especially today, but great Quakerism in the classical sense they moved towards a creedal pacifism, and pacifism is not really everybody a creedal part of Unitarians who sometimes would justify the actions of a John Brown.
Right.
And our actions in World War I, for example, and well, World War II, but not necessarily
others. Yeah, we are clearly not creedally pacifists. The whole John Brown thing is a very complex issue that I don't want to go into here. But yeah, the part about having freedom to make moral decisions is we have freedom to make moral decisions. And being a pacifist is certainly an option, and we have one member of our congregation who did time during World War II because he was a conscientious objector. And on the other hand, Quakers who have a doctrinal view on pacifism also gave us Richard Nixon. So we're all kind of a mixed bag. Jim and then Ray.
You said that you kind of traced a path of Unitarianism from East Europe but it seems that Unitarianism doesn't exist in France and England these days in any significant level. And it also seems like the Unitarian Church in America is quite unrelated to the Transylvanian Church.
We are certainly theologically diverse and have a different emphasis and flavor from the Transylvanian Church. There is not a strong, we have associations and associate groups in France and in Germany and in India and in Japan where we have these liaisons, but when we think of Unitarianism in Europe, except for England, most of the Unitarians are American-based communities in France and so forth. However, in Transylvania, you have a much more Christocentric, old-school Unitarianism that was probably closer to what it was like in the 16th and 17th century. In England, you have a meeting of British Unitarian clergy at Manchester College at Oxford, and I was shocked because it didn't have a lot of relationship to what I saw here. It was Christocentric. They did tend to hide their lights under a bushel. I remember trying to look up a Unitarian church in the phone book, and they were unlisted. I think kind of the ultimate snobbery. I mean, I lived in England. I did a sabbatical in England and couldn't, find a Unitarian church that was close by that actually advertised. You had to know. But I'll actually tell you my big problem was that at this conference, I even want to get into this. At this conference, they invited as their guest speaker a young Trotskyite who, of course, knew everything and got up there and did a 45-minute oration on how all of those Unitarians were traitors to the class, traitors to the struggle, that they were hypocrites at best, that they were useless and counterproductive, and they all... and they had no courage at all. And when he sat down, they all applauded him. So I got up and said, "You can't possibly believe that. I mean, you get up every week and you write your sermons, you go to your churches, you lead lives that presumably you think are useful. Why are you, in an abundance of politeness, making him believe that you believe his condemnation of you?" I sat down, they applauded me. So, just kind of a side trip. Let me go to first before I get back to you, Dennis. Ray?
Yeah, I'm just curious. I know as unions we're not evangelical, but when I was attending Cal State Fullerton, I know that I was very curious to find out about different religious systems, and there was a Christian group, there was a Jewish group that I joined for a bit, and there was a red-headed guy that was trying to Jews to Jesus that anybody went to Fullerton for 20 years knew him. But I never saw, you Mutes, and it seems to me an ideal place to have like a group that I don't know. I'm wondering, are there Mutes in college?
We have had various outreach programs institutionally to colleges. What we have found is that the typical UU, this is not to say not to try this, okay? I want to be clear. I'm not being, we tried that and it didn't work. What we find the pattern for Unitarian Universalists is that we tend to come from either Unitarian backgrounds or backgrounds where we have gone off in our college years and explored and found not this, not this, not this. One of the great entry systems for bringing younger people into our congregations, weddings. So two people, it used to be a mixed marriage, was Lutheran and Calvinist. Now mixed marriage is much broader. But people would come to Unitarian clergy to say, I'm this and she's this. Can we be ourselves here? And we'd have a wedding. And then often later when there were children, people would start to come back and remember. It's really hard when people are in the throes of exploration, of creating their first working lives, to have the continuity from high school through the college years. But we certainly should have a greater sense of visibility so that people will know where to come to get married. I absolutely have a dog in that fight. And to come back to when they have really started to establish their lives. Patrick?
Last Sunday, you were giving us a sermon about Martin Luther King and talking about how segregated we are.
Mm-hmm.
And as I looked around our community, we're gray or white hair, white skin, and we're a very segregated group. When I went to a conference, a group conference, I forget the name, of Unitarians, was it? North of Los Angeles, there was a famous civil rights leader there, a black man, and we then invited him there to speak. And somebody said, "What are we doing that makes us so white and gray?" And he said, "You're doing something wrong. If you want to make it as multicultural, multiracial as you say, we need to change our ways and do something about it. Have any suggestions what we would do to bring the color of America into Unitarian?"
No. Nick asked if I ever got questions I didn't have answers for. No, I don't. I know that we've had a mass of programs of outreach, and here's where I think they have failed. I'm sorry. Here's why I think that. I don't know how to, I'm typical, I know what not to do, but I don't know what to do. And what we have done in the past has been highly motivated by our need to have the comfort of feeling integrated, as opposed to, in a sense, the evangelical notion of we have something really neat to share. So what tends to happen is, first of all, there, and I talked about a little bit in the sermon, there are lots of social pressures on people of color to remain true to their school. There's also lots of guilt from Unitarians and Universalists who want to go and kidnap people of color from their Baptist churches and from their Catholic churches. But we have a very different style and a very different kind of energy. Some of the most talented ministers I know did work in inner city trying to do outreach. And it didn't come from a lack of desire, including my partner, when I was teaching at Starr King, the seminary in Northern California, my roommate downstairs. Everybody else's office was upstairs, but they had the black guy and the Jew downstairs sharing an office. You know, that may say it all. But George Johnson, who had been a Methodist minister, was very disheartened because even he could not bring people of color into his churches. And he did an inner city church. He was very successful in doing a mixed group in organized around politics, but he couldn't get an ethnically mixed group organized around what is essentially a Unitarian Universalist style of worship, which is, let's face it, not very emotional, and is of a completely different style. So how much race is a factor, how much class, education, and just the aesthetics of how people worship, I think they're all factors. We tend, and you may be more acutely aware of this than anybody else, with the possible exception of your wife, is that Unitarian Universalists tend to swarm people of color who come in because we want so desperately to feel good about ourselves. And so it's not a question, I think, of hiding our light. I don't think it's a question of being cold. Well, it may be emotion, in terms of the emotion, colder than many people are used to. But we don't sing like Baptists. You may have noticed. And I'm not saying that is a good thing. I think it would be better if we sang as like Baptists.
I was at Long Beach, gathering Long Beach, what's it called?
District Assembly, the General?
GA.
GA.
And we were singing hymns. And we had three white women out there teaching hymns. And I closed my eyes, a black member of the community went out to the piano and hit the keys and brought soul into the hymns.
Right.
And the place lifted three
people. Yeah, yeah. There's no question that we would benefit if we got out there more. I mean, so should I confess to you the movie that my wife and I went to yesterday? Last holiday. You know, just the chord just changes the energy level. You can kind of, it's like music can be like Shaktipat, you know, just you feel that energy just go through the room. And this is a little bit on the side, but I used to really enjoy watching the Lakers when Kurt Rambis was part. Because you had all these black guys and they're clapping like this, and then Kurt Rambis is clapping off the beat. He's the one guy that's off the beat that just can't get with the program. And it was all, I mean, I don't know whether he was doing it on purpose. It was like invincible ignorance. But we are all aware of the problem, and none of our institutional responses, and so many of them motivated by guilt, have been effective. And I don't have a good fix. Let me go to first before I do seconds. Dick?
What about Sanford? I mean, he's African American. I mean, I don't know what I do. I mean, I read it, the monthly.
UU World.
But I don't know how he's attacked it. Do you know anything? Do you have any insight?
No, he's pointed out the obvious that, you know, that we're part of the most segregated hour in America. And he doesn't have a good fix, except, again, by example. We have more ministers of color. Here's where we have made more progress, and this may get in the way of our evangelizing, meaning spreading the good news into the black community. We had a history quite past Olympia Brown of ordaining women, of our seminaries being more than 50% women. We were the first congregation to set, other than Metropolitan Community Church, which is a gay congregation, to settle openly gay and lesbian ministers. This is not a big selling point in a lot of the African American community. So there are also some values issues around that that we have to deal with. So we've been much stronger on gender and sexuality issues than we have on race issues. Our race issues have been, to a large extent, resolutions and programs that were not particularly effective. One of the experts on growth came out and said, where isn't there a Unitarian church, and wanted to build one in Inglewood. Well, it's not a bad idea. If you were the right minister and you back it, we might conceivably build a congregation, but we would need to be funding a minister on at least a five-year program to build it, and it would be a different style, one that we could learn from, but they didn't fund it. Our own district funded a gay outreach community to West Hollywood, and Bernie, I'm blocking his last name, we changed his name from Bernie, but we funded that, and he died of AIDS, and it never came to fruition. So, you know, there are a lot of things. I got to do, I promised, okay, so do you have one?
No.
No? Okay, I have to go rehearse my ad lib, so I'll take one last question.
I don't know that we necessarily have to worry a great deal about this. I feel that in the United States, that religion sorts itself by temperament. And there's a long article in the paper the other day, which many of them the fact that so many of the black congregations are so hostile to gays.
Yeah.
My experience has been that people who are welcoming of gays are people who are very secure in their own identity, and they were explaining that, you know, a lot of black congregations are hostile to gays because of a long history of being seen as being overly sexualized.
Yeah.
So it sort of brings up all these bad things. I mean, we're not talking the same language, but, you know, in time, I think, these things will sort out. I have a feeling that by the end of the century, which is not that long, you know, in theologic time, or just theological time, that our congregations will look much more like.
Well, I think that they, as you know, I think that that's inevitable also, because when you look at the number of people of color who are in our own families, I mean, this didn't come up in the talk back, but aside from my half-Korean granddaughter, we've got three black, white nephews in our family, and that's not unusual. And I remember about 3 years ago, somebody stood up and said, how many of you have had a person of color in your house in the last year? And my response was, how many of you have a person of color in your family? And I think that we will solve it more socially by our marrying and again, I keep emphasizing marriage. Everybody, get married as often as you can. Except for members of the congregation. If you signed the book, then I can't charge you. But to have your children get married and your friends get married, that will solve, we will solve. But class is going to be a hearty perennial. So where does Unitarian Universalism go? Thomas Jefferson said that he believed that within the lifetime of those then living, that everyone in America would be Unitarian. Shows that even the brightest guy can be really hideously wrong, so take our predictions with a grain of salt also. The core of our belief is that what we choose and what we do in life counts. Whatever may be next or whatever may not be next, what we do on a day-to-day basis brings meaning or uncovers meaning, depending on your theology, to our lives. And that by warming our own little portion of the universe to the extent that we can, that our lives count and that we make a difference. I thank you all for being here, and now I'm going to go hide out and figure out what to say next.